I'm going to read from Luke chapter 19. Luke 19, Luke's account of the triumphal entry. We'll start in verse 29, read through to verse 44. Luke 19, 29 to 44. When Jesus drew near to Bethphage and Bethany, at the mount that is called Olivet, he sent two of the disciples, saying, "Go into the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied on which no one has ever sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you untying it?' you shall say this, 'The Lord has need of it.' So those who were sent went away and found it just as he had told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' And they said, 'The Lord has need of it.' And they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. And as he rode along, they spread their cloaks on the road. As he was drawing near, already on the way down the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of his disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest.' And some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, rebuke your disciples.' He answered, 'I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out.' And when he drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, 'Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation.' This is the word of the Lord." I heard it. Somebody whispered it. Thanks be to God. I said to the 9 o'clock crowd, a couple of them said it this morning too, so we can rehearse that, you know. I say, "This is the word of the Lord," and you say, "There we go. That's good stuff. Thank you. Thank you." This is a relief. That's first page notes. Gone. There. Okay. My wife teaches Sunday school. I have received a warning about the length of the message. Okay. Palm Sunday is the beginning of the most significant 8-day period. I'm going to call it a week throughout the rest of the message. The most significant week in the history of the world. The gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, of the life and work of Jesus, they are not biographies. If they were written as biographies, they're pretty slim, pretty brief. We don't have a life story of Jesus Christ as he lived here on planet Earth. Only Matthew and Luke deal with his birth in any measure. We know nothing about Jesus' early childhood from the age of 2, when he came back from Egypt, around the age of 2, to the age of 12. We have nothing at all. We are told of one event in his life at the age of 12, which Luke gives us, where he goes missing from the caravan that was going back to Nazareth, and he's in the temple answering questions of the religious leaders. And Luke tells us that to tell us who Jesus is and what he was. We know nothing at all of Jesus from that episode at the age of 12 until he shows up on the scene at the age of 30, around 30, Luke says. What we know of his life can be boiled down to his teaching, his miracles, and his death and resurrection. Those are the most important things, and that's the point of the gospel accounts. Not a biography, brief life story, but crucial stuff. John tells us at the end of his gospel account that there were many more things that Jesus did, And if they were all to be told, and he uses a piece of intentional exaggeration, the whole world could not contain the books that could be written. So he did a lot more. And then he says, but these that I have written are written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and believing have life in his name. So as we consider this event on the first day of what has been called Passion Week, passion meaning suffering. This is the week that Jesus will suffer greatly on Thursday and Friday. This is Passion Week, and the first event of Passion Week is this. But the gospel accounts, the events that happen from this day, the entry into Jerusalem, until the resurrection, Matthew has 28 chapters. And 6.5 of those chapters deal with this 1 week in Jesus' life. That's a full quarter of the book. Mark has 16 chapters, and 6 of them deal with this period. That's a third of the book. Luke has 24 chapters, and roughly 5 and a third chapters. That's 1/5 of the total. That's 20% of the book dealing with 1 week. And John has 21 chapters, and 9 of them treat the events of this 8-day period, almost half of the Gospel of John. I'd like to do a word count of the Gospel so I could be more precise about that, but I didn't bother to try to find out how many words are in the Gospel of John and if it comes out to exact half, but it's almost half the chapters as they were divided up. If you knew nothing about Christianity at all, or nothing about the life and work of Christ, and you saw how the four gospel accounts are organized, you would conclude that the last week of Jesus' life was crucially important to his life and to what he was doing. The events of this week, especially the death and resurrection of Jesus on the weekend, are the most important events in the history of the world. They are the focal point of all of human history. The biblical accounts, everything that happens before the cross is pointing towards it. And everything that happens in the Bible after the cross is looking back at it. I said here, I don't know, many months ago, I was leading a Bible study one time, and a lady asked me, can our relatives who have died see what we're doing? And before I could answer, a lady said, it wouldn't be heaven then. But not bad. But in the book of Revelation, there's only, you know, it outlines a whole lot of stuff that goes on in the earth. But the song of heaven is this one event. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain. This is the focal point of the hymns of heaven, the slaying of the Son of God. We have an expression in English that talks about when something is really, really important, the hub of the matter. We call it the crux of the matter. The crux of the matter is why something happens. It's the focal point. It's what everything else points to. And crux is just Latin for cross. When something's really, really important, really crucial, it's the cross of the matter. This week, dear ones, is the crux of human history. The cross is the crux of the matter. It cannot be overrated, overemphasized, or overestimated. This is God the Son come to die. Amazing love, the hymn says, how can it be that thou, my God, shouldst die for me? Jesus comes into the city with his eyes set on the cross. He comes in humility. The triumphal entry is one of the few things in the gospel accounts that all four gospel writers record. Both John and Matthew tell us that when the people welcoming Jesus welcomed him the way they did with the palm branches and the celebration and the crying out of Hosanna, they were fulfilling the prophecy of Zechariah. Matthew says, this took place to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet. What the prophet said was, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you, righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. That's Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. And all Zechariah 9 to 14, the last half of Zechariah, is mainly concerned with God saving his people, Judah and Israel. The king, Zechariah says, is coming. He will, Zechariah says, save his people. He will restore Israel and Judah. The evil shepherds of the flock shall be destroyed. The Lord, Zechariah says, will come and save his people. Idolatry will be eliminated. The Lord is coming. And I can't imagine that the people welcoming Jesus on that day didn't have this in their minds. They are singing his praises. The king is coming. And John tells us that the reason they are so excited and the reason they're coming is because of Lazarus. Lazarus was dead for 4 days, and Jesus brought him back to life. You need to read John 11, I think, and then in chapter 12, I think it is, where the Pharisees are plotting, and it says, because everybody is so excited and worked up about Lazarus coming back to life, they had plans to kill Lazarus. I wish they had. Then Jesus could raise him again. You know, this guy was dead, he's brought back to life, and the Pharisees think the way to handle the problem is to kill him. Talk about missing the message. Go ahead, kill him again. Just keep raising him back to life. Maybe they'll get the message sooner or later. But these people are coming. They're excited. Here is a man who can raise the dead. We have seen him do it. He is on this donkey because he is going to bring us victory. It's not a war horse. It's the donkey, a symbol of victory and a symbol of peace. I think we can be safe in saying these people are not waving these palm branches around and throwing their cloaks on the ground in front of Jesus because they believe that he is going to die on Friday. They do not believe that. They do not see that. They don't get that. And I think we should cut them some slack. I don't know that I would have either. Here we are, a people under Roman oppression. We have been captured, we have been oppressed, we've been denied power and liberty and self-determination. This is the Messiah. We have seen him raise the dead. We want a king who will do to our enemies what our enemies have done to us, and we want to win. This is him. And they are right. This is him. What they're missing is the mission of Jesus and how he is going to bring victory, what he is going to bring victory over. And so he will bring peace and he will bring victory, but he will not do it the way these people are thinking. Not yet. And dear ones, the story of the Bible is not, God doing things the way that we think he should or the way that we would. The Bible is supremely that of God not doing things the way that we think he should or the way that we expect. He does things better. C.S. Lewis said in one of his books, I know a few C.S. Lewis quotes. That's about it. Makes me sound like I've read him. I haven't read him very much. But there's a famous quote of Lewis who says that the problem with people is they don't want enough. And what he was meaning was these people will be satisfied with mere military victory. These people will be satisfied if only they can live the rest of their lives on top of the pile instead of being underneath a military dictatorship. And it's like Jesus is looking at them and saying, that's all you want? You have no idea what I'm going to do. What I am coming to do far exceeds your expectations. I will accept the praise that you bring me. And I just love this. They are singing praises. The Pharisees come and they say, make them stop. There's another one you might wish had happened. If he had stopped them, what would have happened? The stones would have, that would have been an event. The stones will cry out. But Jesus is telling the Pharisees, I want these people to sing my praises. I want them to welcome me. What they're doing is right. Their theology is not all right. They recognize Jesus as the Messiah, and they are glad, and Jesus accepts it. We need to learn something from that. We hold to the truth, and we want to believe every jot and tittle of the truth. But we don't agree with every Christian. Sometimes I don't even agree with myself. We get things mixed up. We get things wrong. And I said, there are Presbyterians meeting today celebrating this, and God accepts it, and they baptize babies. How can God accept that? Because God looks at their hearts. Are they wrong about baptism? I think so. But they're not wrong about singing praises to Christ. And God accepts it. I went to work for a multi-denominational mission 9 years ago. I've learned a few things in that time. There are Christians in the world who aren't Baptists. And they do some things that I think are wrong. And they believe things that I think are not quite right. And God accepts their worship. I think, you know, if you deny Christ, no, he won't accept that worship. But there are differences among us. And that just strikes me that he, even though these people aren't getting everything right, will not stop them from praising him. God doesn't do things the way we think he should. God does things differently. This is partly why we believe the Bible's true. We would never invent. We would never make up the reason Jesus is coming into Jerusalem. He is coming into Jerusalem to be denied and opposed and arrested and beaten and killed. This is God coming down doing all the work. He does all the work. We say we believe it, and we will spend eternity with him. We wouldn't make that up. We had a man at Thistletown one time, missionary, came to visit, and he was preaching to us, and he said there are two religions in the world. There is the religion that says, if there is a God and there is a heaven to gain, you'll get there by having your good outweigh your bad. And if you're good enough, God will let you in. And then there is the religion that says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and we cannot ever be good enough for a sinless heaven in front of a sinless, holy, holy, holy God. And the only way you're going to spend time with God is if God comes down and does, lives the life that we should have lived and die the death that we deserve to die and defeat death and rise from the dead, and he does all the work, and all you do is hang on to him. We wouldn't make that up. If we were making up a religion, we would be with this bunch over here. You be good enough. You be right enough. You be smart enough. You be in whatever enough. And God will overlook the bad part. That's every other religion except one. Only Christianity says it's not about you. It's about him. He did the work. I was listening recently to Don Carson doing a study about the Abrahamic covenant, and a very strange event happens in Genesis 15, I think, where Abraham has this vision and he gets three animals, a bird and an ox and a sheep, or a goat rather, and cuts them in half, not the birds, but he cuts the animals in half, and there's a path with these halves of the animals. And in the vision, there's a fire pot, and the fire pot goes through by itself. This is a representation of God, and God goes through. Now, the covenant was saying that people would make that covenant, and they say, if I break the covenant, may I become like these animals, cut in two and killed. And in the Abrahamic covenant, Abraham is not required to walk through between the animals and make that promise. God does. God does it. God is saying, I'm going to save you. I will do the work. And Jesus Christ is coming in to do the work. And he has his sight set on dying and suffering. And in dying and suffering, he has his sight set on liberating a vast, numberless multitude of people from every tribe and people and tongue and nation and in every age of history. And he will save them by dying. He will save them through suffering. He will save them through rising from that dead. He becomes a curse. God does things differently, especially what it takes for us to have a right relationship with him. And this is still how God works. God doesn't check with me to see how things should happen. I went to print my sermon last night, and the printer wouldn't work. So the computer told me to download something, get it all fixed up. So I went to bed, and I got up, and it had downloaded, and I got on this morning early to print my message, and it won't print. So I ran over to the office with my flash drive, and I put it in, and it said, flash drive not supported. So I went and got another flash drive, and I printed it, and I put it in. It said, flash drive not supported. And I took that out, and I got another flash drive, and I put my sermon on it, and I put it in again. It said, flash drive not supported. And I said, God, you want me to preach? What in the world are you doing? There is a message. Shut up, yeah. So I called Robert, and he printed it off for me. So it's what happened. God doesn't do things the way I want. He still doesn't. And I don't want to bring the cross down, but this is how God works, ways we don't think. You want the best seat at the banquet? Take the last one. You want to defeat your enemy? When he slaps you in the face, turn him the other side of your face too. We don't think like that. But Jesus wants us to think like that. Look at the cross and see. The great things can be accomplished in ways far beyond what you would have invented. Far beyond what you thought should happen in order to save humanity. You want your church to grow? Get a dynamic leader who has all the answers and can thrill the masses with his insight into things, who knows the answers to the questions before you even ask them. Get an ironclad plan that cannot fail. Organize the masses into a well-oiled machine. Buy the program that worked over there, and it'll work here too. But that is not how God works. He uses men and women who will die to themselves daily. We will not spout off about how much we know or how much we have accomplished. We will not allow our credentials to hide the fact that without Christ, we are nothing. We will not allow people to hang on us and rely on us and hope in us and determine right and wrong through us. There's teachers and there's preachers and there's Bible study leaders, and we want to teach what is true, but it's not about us. God does things differently. And you think I'm just cracking a joke. He has allowed me to preach for 45 years. And that is stunningly amazing. That God has saved some people through me preaching. That is unbelievable. This is not how we would do things. I want to quote you a hymn John Newton, John Newton wrote. I ask the Lord that I might grow in faith and love and every grace, might more of his salvation know and seek more earnestly his face. 'Twas he who taught me thus to pray, and he, I trust, has answered prayer, but it has been in such a way as almost drove me to despair. I hoped that in some favored hour at once he'd answer my request, and by his love's constraining power subdue my sins and give me rest. Instead of this, he made me feel the hidden evils of my heart, and let the angry powers of hell assault my soul in every part. Yea, more, with his own hand he seemed intent to aggravate my woe, crossed all the fair designs I schemed, humbled my heart, and laid me low. Lord, why is this? I trembling cried. Wilt thou pursue thy worm to death? 'Tis in this way, the Lord replied, I answer prayer for grace and faith. These inward trials I employ from self and pride to set thee free and break thy schemes of earthly joy, that thou mayest find thine all in me. I prayed to grow and be mature and be wise. And my life got hard. God works in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. And we should thank him for it, because God knows better than we do. And the cross is the most mysterious work of God of all. And I think of that, and I think of the verse in Romans 8 that says that the creation itself groans in eager anticipation of the redemption of the sons of God. The fall put everything out of whack, not just the human heart, but the very creation itself is out of whack, out of sync. And the creation itself is longing for the day when Jesus shall return and we shall be finally, completely, fully what we were saved to be, and the creation will be too. What has sin done? And all of that mess, all of that universal damage that is wrought in the human heart and in the physical world is fixed up by the cross, by what Jesus has set his sights on as he rides into Jerusalem. We cannot measure the success of the church by the number of converts that we make. The old famous story of, I think it was D.L. Moody. I think the story gets changed, but people just say it was their favorite preacher. But I heard it was D.L. Moody walking down the street with somebody, and there was a drunk guy, dead drunk, on the street in the gutter. And somebody said to Moody, he says, isn't that one of your converts? And he said, well, it must be. It can't be Jesus' convert. And that's true. What we do will fail. But what we do through Christ, in Christ, for Christ, by Christ, cannot fail. But it's not always the way we think. He's going to save the world. In Philippians 2:7 in the New International Version, says he made himself nothing. That's how he saved us. He made himself nothing. He who knew no sin became sin for us that we might be the righteousness of God. He became sin so that we might be the righteousness of God. He is born in a manger. He's born in poverty, obscurity, and insignificance. The country he was born into as a citizen is a two-bit piece of property that Rome finds important simply because of where it is. It is hated. It is small. It does not matter. The three wise men go to Herod's throne room. Where is he who was born king of the Jews? They're not going to Bethlehem. Not going to go to a manger. 2 Corinthians 8:9, he gave up riches to be poor. He who was rich became poor so that we through his poverty might be rich. This is how God works. And what does all that have to do with Jesus' entry in Jerusalem? It has everything to do with Jesus entering into Jerusalem. He's coming in to die. Jesus is coming in to die. He has his sights set on the cross. The cross is not what anyone would do to bring salvation to the world. It's upside down to the way that we think. It is shameful and debasing and cruel. It is the most humble act that has ever occurred. Nothing good can come out of such a torturous death. until it gets in the hands of God. Revelation chapter 5, verse 5 and 6, we read this. In Revelation 5, John is upset because there's this big scroll with seven seals, and no one has found worthy to open the seals. And John starts to cry, and one of the elders around the throne comes to John in Revelation 5, 5 and says, "Weep no more. Weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." Don't worry. The Lion of the tribe of Judah can open the seals. Look and see. The Lion, King of the beasts, tear its prey to pieces, rule over the animal kingdom. That's who Jesus is. And between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain. The elder says, "Look and see the Lion." And John looks and he sees a lamb as if it has just been slain. How does Jesus defeat the world? How does Jesus control the world? Opening up the seals, he's letting out events that will happen in the world between his first and second coming. And all these events are in his hand to control. He opens the seals. These things come out when he says so. He's in charge. Look at the Lion, and I look, and the one who is in charge is not the Lion. It is the Lamb who died. That's who controls the world. That's who's in charge. That's who devours his enemies. That's who protects his people. And what we see in the incarnation, in the life and ministry, and in the triumphal entry, and in the death of Jesus, is this. God became a plain, ordinary thing to accomplish his purposes. He made himself nothing. And what Paul means when he says that in Philippians 2 is he became one of us. Jesus Christ humbled himself and became one of us so that we might become the very righteousness of God. Now, dear one, don't miss this. If you don't know Christ, what it takes for you to be saved from your sin is for the eternal Son of God, who deserves for stones to rise up and sing his praises, for him to come down and live here and die. In order for you to be saved, the Son of God had to humble himself, become obedient to death, even the death of the cross. And he did. And in order for you to receive the benefits of his death and resurrection from the dead, you must humble yourself and fall before him and acknowledge the great work he has done for you and call out for him to save you. And do you know what? He will. But if you stand on your haunches and say, "Nah," you know, like Naaman in the book of Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Kings, he wants to get his leprosy healed, and Elisha says, "Dunk seven times in the Jordan River." I'm not dunking in that dirty little river. Is that your attitude? The creator of the ends of the earth has submitted himself to the death of the cross, and you won't bow? This is stunning. He invites you to come and bow. Come and acknowledge that he is king. Acknowledge that for that you need such a great work done for you. That's what it took to forgive your sins, and he will forgive you. And Christian, I beg of you, we live in a world that is busy running away from God. It knows better than God. It denies the existence of God. It wants to be in charge. I will decide my fate. I will do. We will think. We will go. We're in charge. No. How do we touch this world with the gospel? How do we show our humble, loving, powerful Savior to this world. Long answer, not long time we have, but this. Ephesians 4, we shall walk worthy of our calling. And in Ephesians 4, to walk worthy of your calling is to walk in, and I quote, all humility, gentleness, patience, forbearance, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. And we read that and say, that won't work. That won't work. And if you say that, you've missed the whole message. Because the message is, God doesn't work the way we do. And he says to his church, it's not about you being more, you know, more dazzle, more inviting, more love, well, more lovely. But it's not a matter of giving the world what it wants and sort of sprinkling the salt of Jesus on it. It's completely different. We live in a world that is dark and they need to see some light. And the light is humility, like Jesus had, gentleness, forbearance, unity, love. That speaks. The world needs to see it. The world needs to hear it. The world needs to get it. And they need to get it from us. We're not just here to impress the world with our relevance and our insights. We need to live in faithfulness to our calling. And just as the crowd welcoming Jesus into Jerusalem on that first Palm Sunday, there will be those who will not believe that the world can be won through such a thing. But Jesus humbled himself, and the world will be saved. Let us follow him, win those he died for with the very same strategy, and God will use us for the praise of his glory, the good of his church, and the salvation of lost people. God bless you.